Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fateful Mornings, a Henry Farrell novel, by Tom Bowman. Read by Joe Barrett. And yet the wise are of the opinion that wherever man is, the dark powers who would feed his rapacities are there too, no less than the bright beings who store their honey in the cells of his heart, and the twilight beings who flit hither and thither, and that they encompass him with a passionate and melancholy multitude. W. B. Yeats. Part 1. As the sun gained the eastern sky, I drove my truck through a meadow and toward Maiden's Grove Lake. On the hills, aspen trees leafed out like pale green clouds, and scattered in the grass below, violets stood up to the wet, cold spring. Everywhere you looked, summer was promised. Who named the lake Maiden's Grove, I do not know. Probably the same person who named our township Wild Thyme, back 200 years ago, when northern Pennsylvania was still frontier. They arrived, and there it was, a deep glacial rut fed by springs and spilling into January Creek, hooking into the Susquehanna at some point south, and then running hundreds of miles out to the Chesapeake Bay. I came to a right turn, and took the road to where a dozen cottages sat on the shore. They'd been built in the 30s, when the family that owned most of the surrounding land had sold off a few parcels to raise cash. The family, name of Swales, had evidently grown rich again down in Luzerne County. Until recently, they'd left the other three-quarters of the lake wild. The South Shore cottagers were a house-proud and wealthy few who prized quiet and solitude. They stocked the lake with trout and forbade motorboats. At Cottage 7, I pulled in next to a Navy Mercedes wagon and walked to the side yard. The mid-morning sun scattered white light across the lake's blue surface. You could smell the light. Rhonda Prosser, a slender, middle-aged woman with the wiry limbs of a distance runner, crouched in front of a broken basement window. On my arrival, she stood. She wore gray dreadlocks with silver rings and charms woven in. Her face was severe and beautiful, the face of a white woman, to be clear, dreadlocks notwithstanding. I'd seen her and her husband at monthly township meetings in the summer months. They'd made it a project to beleaguer the township supervisor, my boss, Steve Milgram, over fracking. In particular, where was the EPA looking after us, and where was the Act 13 money going? For this, they'd become notable in Holbrook County, despite being themselves residents of New York State, north of the border. Rhonda peered at me over half-glasses, clamped onto the very tip of her nose. "Henry Farrell, Wild Thyme," I said. "Yeah, I know. I was expecting state police," she said. "Well," I said, "so you're going to handle this? Because I called before. I left messages on your machine. People raising hell at Andy Swales's place, and you won't lift a finger." It was true. Andy Swales was a prince of the family and had, that past year, built a stone castle on a hill overlooking the northern shore, along with a small boathouse and a dock. From the Prosser's cottage you could see a turret. Swales leased some of his land and a trailer up there to a young couple named Kevin O'Keefe and Penny Pellings, in exchange for their caretaking the house and grounds. Yet them two were not known for care. Child Protective Services had removed their newborn daughter, Iolanda, about a year ago, in a case that saw a bit of publicity. In addition to the occasional check-in relating to their efforts to get Iolanda back, I'd been on a domestic call to the trailer that winter. Nothing too bad, just hippies and a squabble that went too far. Point being, with Kevin and Penny living up there, a certain local element had new access to the lake, and the cottage owners didn't like it. Starting that spring, any chance they got, they called about some scandal up to Maiden's Grove, somebody playing music too loud too late, or bait-fishing their trout. I told them once you stock a public lake, the fish are the Commonwealth's. But I'd called Andy Swales about the noise. He'd told me his tenants could do what they pleased, as long as they didn't get carried away. His words. Me, I also figured it was a free country, and people were allowed to get drunk at the wrong lake if they wanted. Worst of all to the cottagers on the southern shore, worse than their new neighbors to the north, Swales had signed a gas lease. At some point in the future, they all might look out across the lake to see a derrick punching poison into the earth with nothing but a thin concrete well protecting their water supply. "Well," I said, "the state called the county, and the county called the township, and the township is me, so... The nearest state barracks is an hour away," I said. "I may work with the county on suspects and that. Show me around." We went inside. The interior of the cottage was white and spare. The spaces beneath tables and chairs were empty, the countertops clean, the shelves filled with art books. Life preservers and baseball mitts hung on hooks in a shale-floored mudroom with a bench and a view to the lake. Unlike most of the homes I visited on the job, there was not a thing in this one you could call junk. In fact, the cottage was so little disarranged that I had a hard time believing it had been burgled until I came to the wall fixture that had once held a flat-screen TV and saw the outlines where a stereo had once sat on a chest painted in blue milk wash. According to Rhonda, two vintage stringed instruments had been taken, but not the priceless barn harp, which was crumbling into something more like folk art. She showed it to me and strummed it. It did not play well. In an upstairs bedroom, the burglars had forced open a locked drawer in a nightstand and taken an HK 9mm automatic handgun. Rhonda said it was her ex-husband's, for coyotes, described it as black, hadn't touched it since the divorce. There was a touch of weariness in her voice when her ex-husband came into the story. It was the first I'd heard of the split, so I guessed it was recent. She didn't know if the gun was loaded. It may well have been. There was a nearly empty box of 124-grain full metal jacket ammunition still in the drawer. All the liquor was gone. Downstairs in the basement, any tools not bolted down had been taken. We headed back up to the ground floor. "This is the most valuable thing in the whole place." Rhonda pointed to an oil painting in a golden frame with a picture light mounted over it. "Why turn on the light and not take the painting? Odd. I guess I shouldn't wonder." Cows in a field by a creek at sunset. She straightened it with a brush of her fingers and a flash of turquoise jewelry. "So last night, you got a call when?" Rhonda looked pained. "We set calls to come here, not Syracuse. He did, my ex, Evan. That's where I was last night, Syracuse. The call came to him, but the cottage is mine now, so he called me. The summers we stayed here, we rarely even locked the doors. But friends in Silver Lake had a problem. He got the system, thinking once we have it, we'll never need it. You just don't expect this." "You're a long way out," I said. "So we thought," said Rhonda, and then reconsidered. "No, it's more than that. You keep going along, you've got a good thing. How could you expect this? You're going along..." With an index finger, she whipped tears from under her eyes. "We just have to absorb this now, I guess. There's no place to be."
"Just from my perspective, I've seen it before. It's not personal. These people, they didn't mean you harm. They don't know you. They only know what they need. And that's probably heroin." "So the call came here," I continued. "The dispatcher didn't like it. She called the state police. State police called Evan," said Rhonda, "my ex. And he called you." She nodded. "I'll try to get a few prints and whatnot, but the likeliest way forward is people. People talking." I didn't have high hopes. In the Commonwealth, every house burglary was a felony, and nobody wanted to send their brother-in-law or whoever to prison over a stereo, especially not in the government-resistant culture that had taken root in the hills of Wild Thyme. Maybe I could follow the items over the border to the small cities on New York's southern tier. Probably not. I took prints from the doorknobs, a few surfaces, and had a long look around. The burglars had left nothing behind. Before breaking in, they'd probably taken off their boots, even. I gave my regrets and got on the road. It took about 20 minutes to get back to the station. Rounding a bend, I rolled into the familiar valley and parked on the gravel surrounding the municipal garage. Wild Thyme Township had not always had a policeman on the payroll. I suppose it had depended on how safe people felt and how much taxes they wanted to pay.
Before my return from Wyoming, state, not county, a few years back, the post had stood vacant, and the people relied on Pennsylvania State Police and the Holbrook County Sheriff's Department. It was largely Sheriff Daly's doing that I got the job. He'd wanted to trim back his own department's ambit, and felt that as long as I was up there in Wild Time, I could be of use. In fashioning the police station itself, the township had cornered off a piece of the building that doubled as a garage and volunteer fire station. I unlocked the door and propped it open, then switched on a rotating fan. It never made a difference. Sometimes it felt like the air in my office had not changed since 1967, when the garage was built. Nothing in, nothing out. The desk beside mine remained vacant. My latest deputy, Krista Collins, formerly of the county sheriff's department, worked for me for about 5 minutes before getting herself deployed again, this time to Afghanistan. There she met a sergeant and let me know she wasn't returning to Pennsylvania, probably ever. Even if I could hire somebody, there were precious few academy graduates angling for a low-paying rural post. The applications I did get were from older cops with brutality complaints and discipline problems, guys who fell out with their departments and were looking for rescue. If $11 an hour was worth it, most of them had to be pretty sorry. But I kept a few applications on my desk anyway. I considered manning one of my speed traps throughout the township, but decided against it. It was a lazy May morning after a Don turkey hunt, and besides, as policeman of a small township, it is a fine line between making yourself useful and painting the community's ass. For that reason, I tended to focus my efforts on the King cabs and tanker trucks come in from elsewhere to work the Marcellus Shale play. I called the sheriff's department and asked about any burglaries their way, any suspects. Nothing out of the ordinary in Fitzmaurice or around. I filled out most of a criminal complaint, leaving a space for the offender's names, and put it in a desk drawer. Not long after I had done this, the township supervisor stepped in. He wore a striped polo shirt, Bermuda shorts the color of peas, and dusty work boots. As I mentioned, Stephen Milgram was his name, the middle-aged owner-operator of a contracting business. I privately called him the sovereign individual, or just the sovereign, owing to his libertarian leanings. Being a department of one, I was answerable to the wild-time taxpayers by way of the sovereign. He criticized me publicly, declined to pay for Con Ed, and took away my mini-fridge. "Steve," said I, "glad to see you. Please sit." "Ah, thanks." The sovereign scraped a chair over to my desk and sat on the edge of it. "How are things? Keeping busy?"
"Always, always something."
"I ran into Rhonda this morning."
"Sure,"
I said. "You told her we've got a heroin problem."
"News travels fast," I said.
"Henry." He spat some wintergreen dip juice into a soda bottle. Steve knew roads and their upkeep. He knew the voting people of Wild Time, and he was well-liked. It would have been convenient for me to like him, too. Increasingly, I had the impression that he'd be happy for me never to arrest anyone again and to move to some other county. I said, "Come on, Stephen. I have enough trouble from Rhonda. You ask me,
Stephen.
Maybe she got hit because nobody likes her."
"Come on," I said.
"If you need more work, let me know," Stephen said, standing as if to close the matter. "But we don't want you making up—"
"I didn't make up anything.
Stories, and then putting them in your blotter, scaring the little old ladies in the ladies' club. And it isn't you who decides how much work I have," I said.
"Oh, no?"
"Okay, but please, just read the blotter, the last few months." Heroin's arrival into the countryside had been a shameful secret at first, but you saw stories in the paper now. The truth was, within the past 6 months, I could probably have made as many drug arrests as I had the time and inclination to make. I used to drive around what we called the Heights, a low-income community of outlaws and misfortunates perched on our highest hills, and wave to the people I saw around their homes. Sometimes I'd think, "I know that guy to be a deadbeat. What's in his pockets?" Now, with everything coming in, I had that thought about almost everybody. Ordinary citizens, too.
"I've seen the reports," said the sovereign.
"What, a few burglaries?"
"A few burglaries a month, where there used to be just a few all year. Possession, overdoses, MVAs. If you think I'm catching everything, I don't. I'm on my way to work. I'm not trying to be a prick. You've got to do your job, but you could stand some discretion. You and your reports. As the supervisor walked out my door, I said, Steve, it's not me that's scaring the little old ladies. You see that, right? It was early afternoon, and I was sleeping peacefully at my desk when my phone chirped. A text message from Shelley Bray. With her two kids at school, her husband safe at work, her horses fed, and no clients at the stables, this was my signal to stop by. I had a half-hour window after every text to show up or not. Our system was simple. She never texted me for any other reason, and only ever wrote, Hey there, or How you, or simply, Hi. If I could go, I would. I turned onto Field Sparrow Road and parked my car out of sight on the late Aubrey Dunnigan's farmstead, where we'd had so much trouble the year before. I trotted through his scrubby field to the wooded ridge above. A trail led past a well pad that had been cleared but not drilled. At the moment it was just a silent expanse covered in a wisp of bluegrass. The unit in the rock far below included some of the Bray property. The lease was yet another bone of contention between Shelley and her husband. She was knee-jerk opposed to hydrofracking, a view I shared for my own reasons, but her husband saw that he couldn't keep it away. In the end, he had won. I paused at the forest's edge to look out over the wide golden dell surrounding the Bray's horse farm. It thrummed with life, a braiding flow of light, insect buzz, and wildflower scent mixed with manure and hay. As I crept toward the house, keeping to the tree line, Shelley's two horses flicked their tails in the scant shade of a wildling apple tree, ignoring me. Wurlitzer and Pinky were their names. At the kitchen door, I removed my boots, wary of leaving imprints, and felt a rush of desire and dumb luck as Shelley padded down the stairs. She was a pretty brunette of 40 or so, with a huge devilish smile. That morning she wore only a clean white tank top and striped underwear. Stepping past me to the refrigerator, she removed a pitcher of ice water with lemon slices floating in it. She poured a glass and handed it to me. You look beat, she said. Come on up. Naked under a stream of cool water in the guest bathroom shower, I stood behind her and ran my hands over her abdomen, the muscle and flesh of it now as familiar as her face. My hand moved down between her legs, and my breath got short. Feeling me get hard, she bent forward with one hand on the tile, and with the other guided me inside her, unprotected. It was too good to bear. Jesus, I said, we can't. Shelley gripped me to her with a hand behind my thigh. I want you to come. I broke away before it was too late and stood wild-eyed with my back against the tile as Shelley shrugged, stepped out of the shower, and left the bathroom. I followed. In the guest bedroom, she pulled me to her, and we took our time to finish what we'd started, but with protection. Afterward, we lay side by side atop the bedspread, brushed by the warm breeze moving through the open windows. Hot, she said.
Yeah.
Tomorrow?
Okay, I said.
What, Henry?
What?
Shelley plucked her shirt from the floor and pulled it on over her head. Tugging her underwear up, she said, The thrill is gone?
That's not the problem. That is the problem.
I could leave him. This was the second time she'd said something like this. The first time a week ago, I'd ignored it.
Not on my account, I said. The kids...
Henry, I've known him years. He's not evil. But please understand, he's too broken to be fixed. Don't beat yourself up over the kids. We'd be doing them a favor. Just not on my account. She sighed. Tomorrow, then? As I got dressed, I heard car tires. Downstairs, Shelley cursed.
Henry? I'm out the window.
I had memorized the house's layout for just such a moment, but never expected I'd be dumb enough to let it happen. Barefoot, and as gymnastically as is possible for a 6-foot man, I folded myself through an open window and let go of the sill,
dropping 10 feet to the ground. From there, I slunk behind a woodpile. Around the corner of the house, Shelley and her husband Josh faced each other on the porch. "Surprise, surprise," I heard her say. "The AC died," he said. "You believe that? They sent us home, day off." "I actually don't believe that. Maybe I just wanted to see you," Josh said. "I'm surprised, that's all." I heard the screen door slap shut, lay my head on the grass, and gazed into the blue sky. I thought about my boots. After 5 minutes, I crept to the tree line. This time the horses watched me all the way. Safe in the green dark of the woods, I stopped to look at the Bray place once more and imagine for a moment what it'd be like to live there. I felt bad skulking around in the family's house with all their pictures and things. Please don't think I didn't. But if I'm honest, it also felt good. It was something I needed. I told myself it'd be the last time, just like the time before. I picked up sneakers from home and went back to work, cut out of work at exactly 4:30, and drove back to the tumble-down farmhouse I rented. I put on my camouflage, including green paint on my shiny sneakers and around my eyes and face where the beard didn't cover, and headed into the woods. I sat in cover by the edge of a field, trying to coax a gobbler toward a hen decoy. It was the wrong time of day, and I impressed myself by calling one in almost without meaning to. I had a feeling he was the same bird I'd heard 2 afternoons ago from the opposite hill, and also the huge tom that came to the edge of my yard last evening to taunt me as I ate supper on my porch, wearing only boxer shorts with a hole in the seat. I live in the country, and alone. I'd grabbed the shotgun and stalked him barefoot to the tree line, then stood and watched as he jogged straight down the road ahead of me, too distant for a shot. He'd turned, looked right at me, bobbed his head, and disappeared into the woods. Now he played it paranoid, hunkering down in a line of maples along a creek. I scraped out another quiet invitation on my call. He didn't respond for 20 minutes. Then, far to the east of where he'd been, he made an echoing bleat and strutted into the field. His head turned blue, then red, and then deathly white as he paced in the grass, checking his flank. Saying, "Where's this goddamn hen that won't move? Make me chase you? I don't think so." He was king in his world. I shot him, and through a puff of gun smoke noted the spot where he should have fallen. The walk into the field stretched my legs. Standing over empty ground, I wondered at the power of this bird, half-idiot, half-genius, to disappear. I had shot him, I swear. On my walk home, I followed one of my neighbor's trails into a wooded ravine and back up to leafy woods pocketed with red pine. A clean scent moved through the forest on the breeze, so strong I could only follow. The air was sweet. I stepped off the path and into shadow. Pushing through black branches knit together, eventually I came to a small open ring with an emerald floor of moss, princess pine, and jack-in-the-pulpit. The break in the woods hid a treasure. Standing 3 feet off the ground in the shade of a maple, a single wild azalea bloomed pink, its flowers swaying as if exhausted with scent. "Look at you," I said. I took a knee near the plant and brushed aside some dead leaves on the ground. With my knife, I gathered 2 shoots. Fighting my way back to the path, I cradled the plants like baby birds in my cupped palm. Back home, I grabbed a serving fork from a kitchen drawer and went back outside. I considered the lay of the land and settled on a roadside tree line with a rotting split rail fence in it. In went the wild azalea, no longer wild, nice and easy. Next morning was clear and dry. A tom had run me around since about 5 a.m., and I was having eye trouble to where I couldn't see getting to work on time. I had just got home, stripped off my camo, put up the shotgun, and started the kettle for coffee when my friend Ed Brennan called. The call changed quite a bit. Then, and in years to follow. Ed is a large, loud man, but on the phone that morning, his voice was a murmur, telling a story I didn't want to know the end to. I got dressed in 3 minutes, and with my coffee sloshing out of its cup, drove down to Fitzmaurice. The Brennans live on a small farm outside Fitzmaurice, which you may know is the Holbrook County seat. Liz Brennan is the town's general practitioner, and Ed owns a high-end construction business specializing in timber frame buildings. He has a few skilled guys, but he'll take his workers from anywhere, rehab placements, whatever, as long as they can work. The Brennans have 2 young kids, a boy and a girl. Ed and I went to high school together, 15, 20 years ago. I'm close with their family. They've helped me through troubles. And I might as well say that if you knew Liz, you'd understand how I could love her with the purity of a dog's love and be in no better position than a dog to express how I felt and have no more chance of pursuing her romantically than a dog would have. She's my best friend's wife. I'm telling everything else, so I might as well admit that, too. My life was much simpler when I had my own wife, but I scattered her ashes out west, and she's hard to reach. I pulled into the yard of the White farmhouse. Ed stood in the doorway. He gave me a small wave and moved inside. On the porch, one of Ed's guys sat slumped in a chair. Duct tape held the toes of his boots shut. A baseball cap hid his face, but that didn't matter. It was Kevin O'Keefe, the fellow who lived with his girlfriend Penny in a trailer on Andy Swales' land up to Maiden's Grove. I wasn't sure whether he was asleep or awake until I took the stairs. He shifted and tried to stand. I waved him back and pulled a chair around to face him.
"Are we doing this here?" he asked.
"Not sure what it is we're doing," I said.
"Ed didn't say?"
"Why don't you tell me?" Kev glanced toward Ed's front door, then back at me.
"You're not taking me in?"
"What is this all about, and we'll go from there." I had no place to hold Kevin in my tiny station, not for longer than an hour or so. There was no doubt that this, if it was anything, would be kicked over to the county. O'Keefe lowered his voice.
"I didn't kill her."
He wore a T-shirt, and I looked at his arms for scratches and bruises. His sunburned skin was scraped and lined, nothing fresh, though. "But she's gone," I said.
"Yeah. I got home 2 nights ago. The place is busted."
"About what time did you get in that night?"
"I don't know, 2:30. There's some, Jesus, oh God."
He hid his face in his hands, which were cracked and dry, then looked up again.
"But I don't notice what I should have. I was drunk. I passed out. I guessed she was mad about something, me staying out late or what, and then she'd be back. No shape to go after her. Next morning, still no Penny. I called her phone, I called her sister, called her folks, no nothing. Looking around, you know, I should have seen. I went to work. Come night, still no Penny. Her car ain't moved. I made some more calls and went out hitting the bars. Binghamton, Endicott, down to Fitzmaurice. Nobody's seen her."
He raised a hand to pick at his eye. The hand trembled. "Okay, now, what about this? You said you shot somebody? That can't be right, right?" Ed had told me this part of the story over the phone, without details. It didn't fit. No gunshot wounds had come into Holbrook or in neighboring counties. Likely this was a bad dream, or a delirium from too much or too little alcohol in the blood. Kevin gave no reply, and then said,
"I shouldn't have said that. Forget that, I'm wrong. I was drunk. I didn't shoot nobody."
"Okay, so where was it that you didn't shoot anybody?" Kevin sighed and raised his eyes to the heavens. "Where's the gun?" I said. He put an index finger to his temple and pretended to blow his brains out. It was not for my benefit, I don't think. Our eyes met, and I knew that something was wrong with Kevin and with the little place where our lives met. "Tell me where you've been, Kev. You've got to tell me right now."
"Promise me you'll go after Penny. She could be... We're wasting time."
"Stand up, please." I patted him down, catching body odor that was sharp like cheese, sweet like bread or beer. No weapon.
"If she's dead, I didn't kill her."
"Well," I said. O'Keefe extended his wrists to be cuffed.
I shook my head. How'd you get here? Walked?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?